Hello and welcome back to a long-awaited return of Rain Stop Play. Looking at our calendar, I think it's been exactly a month since our last episode. So thank you for patiently waiting while a couple of us enjoyed a nice long August holiday. Today I'm joined by Zach as Dan remains on holiday. He is still gallivanting around the USA. We'll hear a lot more about that when he returns to the pod in a week or two. And Will, to my knowledge, is busy finishing his master's dissertation. So two very good reasons to be absent, but I'm delighted to be joined by Zach today for a long-awaited catch-up, not just for us, but just to talk about cricket as well. We've already had a bit of a preamble talking about fantasy for 20 minutes because it's been so long since we've kind of hung out and chatted. But looking at the cricket now, Zach, how are you doing? It's good to see you again.
Yeah, it's good to see you again, Glenn. You know, there's been lots and lots of cricket on, as there seems to always be. We have had a little bit of a pod break, so we're back fresher than ever.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've broken the hiatus, and I think I've got a bit of renewed energy. I think we've got a lot of really, really big stuff to talk about, from Test cricket, T20, and a bit of the 100 as well. So it should be a really exciting next 40 minutes or so. Before we do dive into the professional cricket, Zach, you know, it is pretty customary at this point for us to start the pod with our own personal sporting exploits. Have you had any? I know that you're going to be moving away pretty soon, but have you had any? You got a big final hurrah in Leeds playing cricket at all?
I've got a game on Saturday, so that will be my final game. I played over the bank holiday weekend. I played three games in 3 days, which was, I played a game against some Afghan refugees, which was a good game. We won. We chased down their score of 150 odd they set us.
Proper game.
I scored 20-21 from 15 balls, I think, and then got caught out when we needed less than a run a ball.
So, you know, Milan innings, David Milan.
Yeah. It's a bit insulting, Glenn. The next day I played a Saturday game and I bowled 8 overs, 2 for 12, which I was very happy with, and then scored 20-something, batting at 3, which is far too high for me, but scored 24 and we won. So, you know, winning games. That's all it is, Glenn. Just winning games.
Fantastic stuff. And I do always like your modesty, I think, Zach, when you're talking about your cricketing exploits. You know, it sounds like you've had a really solid season. Would you say, just before we get into the South Africa test, would you say it's been your most consistent season since you kind of restarted playing a couple of years ago?
Yeah, I would say so. The annoying thing is, I think I have actually scored a similar, in Saturday cricket, I've scored a similar number of runs to last year, but I've played for the better teams this year. I've played against better teams. So it's, you know, it works out. And on a weekday in my LMS cricket, my 20 over cricket, I've scored the same amount of runs. My average is the same, but my strike rate is way better.
Wow, look, there you go. So
we'll take it. Yeah.
I would agree, a bit more aggressive and proving you're able to do it against better opponents. Good stuff. For me, we finally won a game of football, which is fantastic. The full season started 2 weeks ago and we won our first game of the season 3-1, which was amazing. I think that was the first game in a year since I moved to Iowa that my football team has won a game. So I was buzzing, kept a clean sheet in the first half as well, which has never happened. Then last week, unfortunately, we did get beat about 5-3. But I'll tell you what, Zach, you know, I like a win when I'm on the pitch. It's not the be-all end-all. I'm not super competitive, but I enjoy, you know, it's fun to get a win. But this was actually a game. We did lose by a couple of goals, but the quality of the football was so good. Like, our team played so well. I actually just had a really nice time. They scored some absolute screamers as well. I know I say that, I've got an excuse every week. It was a slippy ball, it was in the top corner, whatever. But the opposition team and one of our players, Dave, who's another English bloke, actually scored some cracking goals. So it's nice to see us both enjoying our sport. But enough of the amateurs. Let's get stuck into the pros that we're here to talk about. Zach, we've had a couple of test matches since we last spoke. Obviously, as everyone knows listening, South Africa are currently in the midst of a tour of England with a very, very strange long break between the second test and the third test, which has been spoken about a little bit. But it's been a series of extremes so far, I think it's fair to say, Zach, right? So we've had two very lopsided games. South Africa winning the first one by an innings and 12 runs just a couple of weeks ago. in August, which was, yeah, a pretty solid win for them. Surprising. It was quite nice that it's been quite fun, I think, for the captain, Dean Elgar, to bring a bit of chat to this series. I've liked it. It has come across potentially as a little bit, as a little bit, maybe pathetic's a bit strong, but he's really brought in some of the kind of animosity that I think actually can really stir up some good cricket. And he backed up his words with some actions in the game, and South Africa obviously came away with the innings win there. And then we kind of flipped the table, I guess, for the second one, with England this time winning by an innings, even more convincingly, in 85 runs after they declared on 415 for 9, and then South Africa was skittled out twice for under 200 runs. So two very convincing wins for each team. There's only been 3 innings in each game so far, so I really hope that the final test, which we're going to get into in just a second, will be a little bit tighter. But Zach, just give me some of your kind of, I guess, big picture takeaways so far from the series as it stands right now. It's been really competitive from my end. There's been some really good quality cricket. Clearly bowlers to some extent have been on top with the amount of wickets that have fallen so quickly. But for you watching it back home, what have been some of the kind of narratives that you think have been the most pressing that have emerged from this? I think it's been an electric series so far.
Yeah, it's been really good, and we knew that it was going to be a different challenge. I think South Africa's bowling attack, the pace attack they had in the first test with Norkia, Rabada, and Ngidi and Jansen is a very, very good pace attack. And we knew that it was going to be harder to play against South Africa, and it proved so immediately. I felt like in England there was a lot of kind of comfort in England collapsing, which I think is such a weird English thing that we have, that it was like, oh, we're bad again. Oh, thank God, we can all complain about how bad England are again. Like, everyone was getting a bit worried that the test team was going to be good for a bit. But yeah, and then the second test, we looked good again. I think the main takeaway, I think, is that both teams have pretty good bowling attacks and the batters aren't amazing. Really big innings for Folkes, really big ton. Really big innings for Stokes as well, him to get a ton, his first ton as captain, on the day his documentary came out as well.
Beat me to it.
Just absolutely brilliant. The narratives, this bloke, you know, there's been a famous quote flying around that is, who writes, someone said this to Ian Botham back when he was at the peak of his powers, it was, who writes your scripts for you? And I thought that was, it's so perfect for the day of him getting this ton. And yeah, it was really good to see. And he also, you know, Stokes bowled really well. Like, took a couple of really important wickets in that. South Africa were never really going to chase the total, but they were never going to really set England anything that was going to trouble them. But they were 140 for 3 at one point during their second innings, and they ended up getting, you know, skittled for 179, with, you know, Varane staying in with a lot of people and, you know, no one sticking with him. But yeah, I think Stokes got the kind of important wickets in that chase, got them to 150 for 5, and then, you know, Robinson and Anderson came in. Again, Ollie Robinson looks very good, bowling a lot quicker. There was balls up at 85 miles an hour during that, which I think is really, really good to see. His pace didn't seem to be dropping off quite as much as well. So great to see he's back. Hopefully he's just sorted now, and we can have a fit firing Ollie Robinson for years to come.
Yeah, absolutely. Some great points you picked out there, Zach. Let's stick with the batting just to get us started. As we both agreed, I think it's been a game where ball has clearly been on top of bat. But yeah, there's still been some standout performances. You've touched on a few of them. I think back in the first game, Pope's 73 was great to see. I mean, I was really glad to see him. Just finally show, I guess, what he can do at number 3. It feels like a bit of a poison chalice, that position for England in recent years. Again, we've talked about this before, since maybe Trott, it's been a difficult spot to play. We've tried Root there, we've moved him around, we've tried others, a succession of people who kind of start doing fine and then kind of drop off, maybe Milan being the last one who impressed there in the Ashes and then really fell off. So yeah, he got a bit of a statement innings, I think. A shame he couldn't maybe convert that into the 400. But opening, I we don't have to spend too much time on this. It's a conversation that a lot of people have had, including us, multiple times. But the opening two, again, there wasn't really enough for me from the 3 innings we've seen that really convinced from either Lees or Crawley. Yeah, Zach, you're shaking your head. Moving forward, obviously we have the game in a couple of days, starting on Thursday, I think it is this week, which I'm really looking forward to. It does feel like there's once again a huge amount of pressure on Crawley, which we know, but maybe a bit more on Leeds as well, considering he hasn't really fired at his best. What are we doing with the openers? I mean, where are we at with them? It seems to be, it's been a pretty disappointing series for them so far.
I think neither of them are good enough to play Test cricket. Simple as, at this point in time, neither of them are good enough to play Test cricket. Zach Crawley is worse, but he had that innings where he played a gritty 38, as everyone was calling it, and was getting praised for it. And also, in Rob Key's mind, he doesn't seem to be able to do any wrong. So, is he going to be dropped? No, apparently not, because he's got these... I think Paul Collingwood said it. I think it was after the first test. He said he plays match-winning knocks, whereas... The stats are actually, he's only ever scored one 50-plus score when England have won a game. In that game, he was the third highest scorer. It was in Johannesburg in that South Africa series back in January 2020. So, you know, he doesn't play match-winning knocks. All of his good knocks are when we've drawn games. So he's good when people can't take wickets, basically. It's kind of it. He's not very good, pretty much, but he looks good. But he needs to go. He needs to redefine. He needs to refine himself. He needs to have a couple of years in county cricket scoring some runs, because he's actually never done that. And there was always talk about that. And I was on board with him, but he looked really good in the Ashes earlier this year. But he's just, again, not delivered. The stats for how many tests he's had, for how poor his record are just amazing, because they're so bad. And he's top of all the records. But the problem with this is... Of players to play as many innings as him, he has the worst average for England. I think only the third in the world, but the second and third worst, or at least in the bottom five for England overall. This is in all tests ever to have played as many innings opening the batting. Obviously, it does discount that he scored 260 batting at three, but opening the batting in as many innings as him, the third and fourth are Sibley and Burns, who were the candidates to come back in. They've also had as many innings and have only done slightly better. And you know, I know you're probably going to ask me moving forward, who do we go back to? And I do think Sibley and Burns are probably our best openers, which isn't great to see.
Yeah, fantastic use of the stats there, Zach. Thank you. Because it has felt like there's been a bit of a disconnect for me, and I think a lot of English fans, between the narrative that Key and other people in the team kind of build around Crawley, that he's this kind of aggressive, kind of elegant, and to some extent he is both of those things. The way he plays when it comes off, don't get me wrong, I don't dislike him. I think when he's playing well, it's beautiful to watch. But there does seem to be a disconnect between maybe his impact on the team, right, Zach, the outcomes of those innings, how pivotal they've been to wins, and then the stats completely contradict that, right? So they're kind of framing him, you're just seeing this disconnect between how he's being framed and maybe sold to the English fan base, to, you know, the setup. Well, hey, he is this match winner. And you've just, you know, done some brilliant work. And I'm glad you brought this up, because you did put that in our group chat, I think, a couple of days ago. You know, you've done the works, and the stats just don't support that at all. So that's interesting. It does feel like he is kind of like, you know, the teacher's favorite in some way, right? He is just this golden boy that can do no wrong. And it's interesting, and we'll get onto the T20 squad in due course, which I'm excited to talk about as well. It's interesting to see Jason Roy, again, probably for the right reasons, we'll get onto this, you know, dropped when perhaps, I've seen a few comments say on BBC just this morning that, you know, does he not have more credit in the bank? You know, talking about what he's done, talk about being a match winner. Jason Roy has been that across formats for England, across one day formats for years and years. He's been absolutely sensational for us, say what you will about his technique. So there does seem to be a bit of a disconnect, and that Crawley just has this kind of untouchable position within the setup, which I don't think, Zach, is very healthy necessarily for a team if someone does keep consistently not performing and they feel like they're undroppable, or they, maybe I'm not trying to have a go at Crawley here personally, but it seems like they're undroppable. I don't think that really necessarily builds the kind of atmosphere within the team that you might want, right? People are going to feel, or people waiting in the wings, your Sibley Burns, are going to feel pretty frustrated by that.
I think also Mark Butcher put it really well when he was on comms in the first test, that it's actually not fair on Zach Crawley to just keep putting him out there when he clearly can't do it. Like, it's not fair to him. Like, we've played cricket, it can be fun when you're not getting runs, if you never get runs, but there's no media pressure when we play, whereas there's so much pressure and there's so much talk. He needs to just be taken out of the spotlight for a bit, have a chance to go back. He's still so young. He needs to just be have a chance to go back to county cricket. I think he's still only 24. So there's plenty of, like, he's got plenty of time to go back, have a couple of years, you know, playing cricket and get some runs on the board, and then he can come back and maybe he'll bat at three eventually, maybe he'll bat at five eventually. Because I don't know, it doesn't seem like opening works for him at this point.
Absolutely, and it feels like he was kind of, you know, fast tracked into the England team. Obviously, he got that absolutely stunning double hundred. But yeah, I think he's just kind of run out. His technique has run out of road here. And honestly, Zach, I think we're both among a lot of people kind of tired of talking about this. Like, I don't want to criticize cruelly every single podcast. A, it's boring, and B, I feel bad because yeah, he's clearly talented. But yeah, I agree with you. Maybe it's just not the right environment for him to be in right now, and he needs to work on that technique. So with that in mind, moving forward, the next test after the South Africa series, I know it's going to be Lees and Crawley, and to an extent, rightly so, because why change it third game? But moving forward beyond that, would you want to see both of them change just before we move on? Would you like to see that double change up top?
I don't, it's difficult, isn't it? Because I think potentially yes, but then it would need to be you're not going to have two people debuting on the same test. But I think the most likely thing is we go back to Sibley and Burns. But just no, because no one else is really, no one's pulling up trees to open the batting for England. All of the kind of people who are getting touted, you know, we've obviously got Harry Brook, who we'll come onto in a minute because he looks set to debut. Ben Duckett's been added to the squad. They're not opening batters, and this has been an issue for England for again a long time. There's a list of 30 batters have opened the batting for England since Strauss retired, I think it is, and. I think it was a Wisden article by Ben Gardner, and he ranked them all, which was really good, as his pieces often are. We can link it under the pod, and he ranked all of them. And it was like, oh, so many people. I was just like, bloody hell, they played for England. Oh God, remember them? It's just Jason Roy. I always forget Jason Roy played that Ashes series.
Yeah, and I've seen him open for England, and it was awful. Mark Stoneman and all these people that you just kind of forget ever existed, right? Just this kind of succession of players, and this is the unfortunate thing, because credit to those players, clearly they're good enough, Zach, right, in theory they've worked so hard in county cricket to get that chance. I don't want to, you know, knock the work and quality they do have, but clearly what we haven't found is that consistently elite kind of top two batters. Anyway, it's just moving on from that. It's interesting if not slightly depressing stuff. We'll just stick with the batting for a second and look down the order. So obviously we've got Pope, Root, Bairstow, Stokes, Folkes and Stokes in the second test coming through with those sensational hundreds. Pope got the, you know, 70, which I really hope he gets a good score in the next game as well. And Joe Root, no need to say anything more there. Whatever his form is, he's one of, if not the best player in the world. Now, the gap that we're going to find for this next game, right, Zach, thanks to a slippy golf course, I'll come to you on the details in a second. It's kind of current theory, we think. Johnny Bairstow, the most informed player for England this summer. He has been outrageously good just all the way through, especially in this test team. He's probably been the person, I think, that has embodied this sense of baseball, right? Who's embodied this sense of, you know, aggressive, yet still just quality, yet exciting test cricket, right? He is the man this summer. And now he's slipped over. Not quite sure what the extent of the injury is. Could be a break. We're not too sure. See if you know. But he's out. And not only is he out for the next test, which is, you know, sad unto itself, he is out. It's a serious injury. And he's going to miss the T20 World Cup as well. We will get there. But Zach, just a very quick reaction. Do you know that the further details of what happened to Bairstow and who's going to come in to replace him this week for the third test?
So Dan's going to hate this because it's going to show up my lack of knowledge of golf. But supposedly he slipped whilst he was on his way to a tee box. I don't know what a tee box is, so sorry about that, Dan. But he slipped on his way to a tee box and has potentially broken his leg, which seems so just rogue, and it's such a freak accident. And yeah, it's mad, and it's such a shame because, like you say, it's been the summer of Bairstow, and you're so right. He is baseball. Him just smacking fours, and it's just smacking fours through the covers, yep. Just consistently going at basically a run a ball.
Yep.
It's been so good to see, and he's he looked so good in that New Zealand series. He's a little bit undone in this series by Nokia's extra pace, but you know, pretty hard to face bowling that's consistently above 90 miles an hour. I presume everyone seems to say it's pretty hard.
It is. Yeah, so
it's a big shame, and he will be a big miss in the T20 World Cup because, you know, no, if you just said to me a year ago, oh, we're not going to have Bairstow or Roy for the World Cup, I'd have been extremely worried and shocked as well.
Absolutely. No, and we will get that. I'm really looking forward to this chat about the World Cup squad because, yeah, there's some kind of fundamental changes there. But just sticking with this game coming up. So Harry Brook, he seems to be the man to come in, right, Zach? What are your initial feelings like? How's he been playing for maybe listeners, international listeners who don't know a huge amount about him? How's he been playing, you know, domestically the last couple of months? And do you think he's going to make a mark in the potentially quite limited opportunity he gets here in the Test team? What are you hoping for from him?
Yeah, I think it's been a bit difficult for him because he's not played a lot of cricket recently because he's been 12th man basically. He's been in the squad. He's played a few hundred games. He's obviously not played. He's not played a first class game in a while, but you know, is what it is. Neither had any of the South African players before they rocked up at Lord's and battered us, so you know, that's not always a thing to judge it on. But he's got, you know, 967 runs across and only played 8 games in the county championship this season. No one has played as fewer games as him in Div 1 and scored as many runs. So he's looked so good batting 5. I think he's been batting for Yorkshire and just scoring at a really good rate as well. A proper kind of baseball player. He's been scoring around kind of 80 or 90 strike rate. And yeah, interesting to see Ben Duckett back in, has come back into the squad, but we presume Holbrook will play and Ben Duckett obviously be kind of that extra kind of squad batter in case there's an injury during the game, or, you know, so you can have sub him out. But yeah, interesting to see them both kind of in the fold. Both scored a lot of runs this year at a good strike rate, which is kind of what they kind of seem to be wanting with under Baz McCullum. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see how he goes. I hope he gets, you know, some runs. He looks really good, and he's been kind of next cab off the rank in all formats for a little while now. And I think we could see him playing for England in all 3 formats for a long time to come.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's what I was going to say, actually, Zach. Really nice kind of overview, I think, there of his ability. He strikes me as maybe a more... It's interesting. There's kind of two parts to him here. I think he's quite a traditional English cricketer in the sense that we're looking at him for all formats, which isn't necessarily something that we're doing with a lot of players now. Right, I think about some of the Somerset boys, Will Smead especially, who just seems destined for... T20, 100, whatever else, limited overs, greatness. Whereas what I love about Harry Brook is, as you rightly articulated, he does it across the formats and he does it really well. So he's this kind of, you know, classical cricketer in the sense that he seems up for all formats, seems to really care about the longer form of the game too, which I love. But at the same time, Zach, he's also a distinctly modern cricketer in the sense that he fits into this kind of baseball paradigm, right? He really does. He plays aggressive cricket. He's, you know, he scores quickly. I love that you brought that up. You know, he scores quickly in games and he's quite an aggressive batsman, right? He definitely isn't going to come up. I'll be so intrigued. I really hope he plays. It sounds like he will. He's not really going to come up and I don't think maybe tone down his game for this series. I mean, I hope he doesn't because it's been so successful. And he was great even in my Blast, I think, fantasy team. He scored loads of runs in limited overs this year. So I'm excited. I guess, do you see him, final kind of thing on the middle order, then we'll get onto the bowlers very quickly, but do you see him as being, you know, if he does well, not just in this game, obviously you can't judge anyone by 2 innings, but do you see him being part of this England setup in the long term? Do you see him as being the kind of, as you said, next cab off the rank, but you see him being like that person, if one of the middle order isn't really around, that he's going to be hopefully kind of ushered in to play that role?
Yeah, I think there was before folks got the ton, I think there was talk about giving Bairstow the gloves and bringing in Brook. But I can understand, obviously, now folks has got 100, that there's no reason to do that. You know, you do want your best wicketkeeper. Folks is a very good wicketkeeper. Everyone knows that. There's no doubt on that side of it. His batting was looking a little bit kind of not great because he's not had the best summer in between. Well, he has had a very good summer now, but before that knock it was just, I think, 150, which was where he was guided England over the line with Root in the first test of the summer, which looked good. But yeah, now he's got that 100 and he looked really good, just so solid that I think he's probably in for a little while to come. But yeah, I think I think it's going to be, like you say, Brook is going to be, he's going to be the next man still for a little while, which is not a bad thing to have. England don't usually have that, to be fair. Like we said, we don't have it with the top three. We've got no one knocking on the door, but he's been banging on that door. He's been banging that door down for a little while now. And like you said, in all formats, he's been doing that. And yeah, had a really good, in T20, had a really good PSL. You know, be interesting to see how he goes in all formats.
Yeah, absolutely. Great stuff. And I'm really excited to see how he does. And hopefully he does very well. Just briefly before we move on to the limited overs stuff, with obviously big news there. Looking at the bowlers, again, this, I do apologize to, South Africa and fans and listeners. Like, it's been quite England-centric so far. I do want to note that their bowlers obviously have been fantastic. Rabada and Nokia, both equal top wicket takers so far in the series with 9 each. It's some very nice averages of around the 20 mark. But with that said, obviously England's bowlers did a superb job in the second test, right, Zach? So Jimmy Anderson, 7 wickets, an average of 16, is outrageous, really, you could say, at his age, to do it so consistently. Where's your kind of mind at with the English bowlers, right? I think it's great to see Ollie Robinson come back in, and as you said, he looks a little bit different, he looks fitter. He said he's worked on his fitness. It's been a criticism, unfortunately, that's kind of dogged him, I think, throughout his England career. If he's fit, I've never doubted his, you know, commitment, passion and quality, really, for the team. He's a very useful option to have. Obviously, we've got Broad and Anderson, you know, in the twilight of their careers, but still there on merit. They're not there as legacy players. They're there because they are two of, if not the two best bowlers we have right now, right? What have you kind of, has anything particularly stood out to you from this bowling attack? Maybe Jack Leach has looked good. I mean, he bowled 23 overs for just 26 runs, 13 maidens, an economy of 1.13. A critique of Leach early in his England career, Zach, was that he couldn't buy a maiden. He couldn't buy one. He was milked no matter where he played. And let me say this, he wasn't helped by very poor captaincy and management. But it's been great to see Stokes and Baz and everyone else kind of empower a few of the bowlers, especially Jack Leach, to say we back you. And they've shown, people have responded positively to the kind of encouragement they've received. What are you thinking about this bowling lineup? I mean, obviously we don't need to do the Anderson Broad thing again, but it feels unlikely that there's going to be much more of this in the coming years. Yeah, what are your kind of takeaways from the bowling just before we move to the World Cup?
I think Anderson could go on and on. He seems to get better and better. Anderson,
I agree.
I don't see where he's getting worse. I think Broad, I think we're probably coming to the end for Broad though. He just looks a bit off it. You know, he takes the odd wicket, but he just doesn't look anywhere near as threatening this year. And you know, he didn't take the new ball, which Robinson took away from him, which when he then did bowl well, because you know he always has to have a bit of something. I think he took took 3 wickets in the first innings, not taking the new ball, which I think was the first time they'd not taken the new ball together when they'd played in a test together for something like 10 years or something. So, yeah, it was big that they took it away from him. But Robinson looks very good. But I don't think if everyone's fit, Broad is in our top attack. But everyone is never fit. But I would rather have Anderson, Robinson and Wokes, or Anderson, Robinson and Archer, but these people are not fit, so these are hypotheticals.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, Broad, to be fair to him, still has contributed with plenty of wickets across the two games. He has still been getting wickets, but yeah, I think it's fair to say that Jimmy maybe looks the more consistently threatening out of the two of them. And yet again, I think this is the thing, right, Zach? This is an England team that just cannot keep our quickest bowlers fit. And we've talked about before, it's always a concern with Stokes' fitness. And you talked about how well he bowled in that second test, which he did. He looked fantastic. It's such a worry to England fans, right? Seeing being so reliant on him to, you know, bounce teams out and stuff, because we maybe lack that kind of extra bit of pace. But yeah, interesting to see going forward. I hope Anderson and Broad can stay fit for as long as possible and just keep providing England fans with just what has been a sensational career. I mean, they've both been just such incredible servants for the game, and it's great to see them still stand head and shoulders above potentially others as well. Right, I think we kind of done as much as we can with the kind of South Africa series so far. I'm really intrigued to see how the third test goes. We will be more focused on South Africa in our next podcast, which we're going to release with a slightly bigger overview, I guess, of the three games together, and really focus on some of the South African star performers. I mean, yeah, with the bowl they've been great, but with the bat they've been lacking a little bit, I think it's fair to say. Anyway, let's move on to the T20 World Cup squads, right? So Bairstow's injury was announced literally hours after Rob Key said he was set to open in the World Cup, which was a bit of a nightmare for England, and leaves with a massive hole in the side. As we touched on earlier, right, Zach, Jason Roy, who has been a pivotal member of England ODI and T20 teams, has just been in his form has flatlined. I think he went from kind of bad form to horrific form and just kind of kept tumbling. So, and as Rob Key said, I think he was quite honest about it, right? Fairly so. He was like, listen, it was one of the worst times for Roy to have this run of form right before a major tournament. It feels silly picking him and putting him at number one, considering he's actually been a bit of a hindrance in recent games that we've seen by starting off so slowly. So with all that said, right, who's coming in for you? Who is filling this void at the top of the order for you, Zach?
So for me, before Rob Key said about Bairstow opening, I thought they would go Butler and Milan, because Milan has been batting at the three for England. As been well documented in this podcast, I'm not his biggest fan, but he's had a brilliant summer, brilliant 100, top run scorer in the men's 100. So, and he's been opening the batting in that. So why doesn't he step up? He can open the batting, and then we'll have Stokes, who's come back in, who hasn't played a T20I in a long time now, but I think he's very good. His record isn't the best, but I think he hasn't often batted in the place which is best for him, which I think is in the top three. And for England, that's been a place where there's, you know, we've got a fair amount of options, well documented. But I don't think that is actually what they're going to go with now. I think they're probably going to plug Salt straight in, because Salt was kind of the spare batter in the squad. They will plug Salt straight in, and he will probably open with Butler. I think Milan will bat at three and Stokes will bat at four. The only issue this then brings is that if we have Moeen batting at five, which we could do, then that's a left-hand 3-4-5. Leaves us a little bit susceptible to matchups. You know, people can just line up their left-handers, off-spinners, but there aren't that many good off-spinners in world cricket at the moment, so particularly in T20 cricket, so it's not too much of a worry. But yeah, I think the bowling is certainly more of a worry for England, because, you know, Geoffrey Archer did a post on Instagram that got us all, got me in particular, saying, well, if Geoffrey Archer's in this World Cup squad, we're emergency podding straight away. That's happening. We've got to get on. But yeah, he's not in the squad. Hopefully there's something soon about him coming back, because, you know, a fully fit Geoffrey Archer, it's what we need. It changes our team from being like, oh, you know, this is an all right team, probably not going to win the World Cup, to, yeah, we're up there. We're probably one of the favourites.
Well, yeah, he would transform the team. And just for listeners to run through the England squad for the World Cup, if you haven't heard, because I want to just briefly, before we pause for the end of our first part, Zach, just look at our bowling options too. But this squad that we've got right now: Butler, Josh Butler, Maureen Ali, Harry Brooks, Sam Curran, Chris Jordan, Liam Livingstone, Dawid Malan, Adil Rashid, Phil Salt, Ben Stokes, who hasn't played T20 for England for a while, actually, Rhys Topley, David Willey, Chris Wokes, Mark Woods, and then travelling reserves, Liam Dawson, Richard Gleeson, Tamal Mills. I think our fast bowling's looking, I mean, unless Mark Wood is back to his absolute feisty best, it's fair to say, it worries me a little bit. I think our bowling's a bit of a concern. How do you feel, Zach? Again, we'll preview the World Cup fully, but just while we're looking at the squad, I don't think our quicks are particularly threatening, you could argue. What would you say?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think Topley's had a really good summer. Is he world class, or is he just having one of those summers? I'm undecided. I think he's just probably having one of those summers that could continue into October. He didn't have the best time of it when he played a few games for the Melbourne Renegades in the Big Bash last year. But yeah, I think Topley's very good. Sam Curran's been bowling pretty well, even at the death, for the Oval Invincibles, which is interesting. It's not something that's, you know, he's ever thought of as being good at. I think he could play and bat at seven and be that kind of couple overs option. If you've got kind of Stokes, Moeen and Livingstone in the top six, then you can have someone at seven who doesn't necessarily have to bowl four overs and can be kind of couple overs at the top. But yeah, I think at the death is the real issue, because Chris Jordan has been pretty poor, looked better against South Africa. And like I think we've said previously on the podcast, he looks good when he bowls the more of a back of a length delivery rather than going for his Yorkers. But these obviously only work at big grounds, because if you've got back of a length and it's a small kind of square boundaries, it's still going to go. But Australia, the grounds are generally pretty big. So I think it could work. Mills only being a reserve is an interesting one, because we've just got two pace bowlers and a spinning all rounder as the reserves there. I think Mills, if he's fit, is very good, but has been a little bit lacking in recent times. We are just missing a death bowler pretty much there. I think we've got kind of other bases covered. Markwood's pretty good through the middle, but again, at the death is not the best.
Absolutely. Great overview. Thank you, Zach. Yeah, I think you echo some of my concerns. I mean, yeah, and Richard Gleeson's an interesting one. We're going to briefly touch on the 100 towards the end of the pod, but it was a bit sad to see him, you know, not finishing it off for his team. And I guess, you know, a red flag maybe is a bit strong. Anything can happen in five balls. I mean, let alone six. But yeah, I really like Gleeson. I think he's a cracking player. But to be honest, I think he's in that very uncomfortable kind of middle ground between excellent domestically and probably just not quite cut out for the top of the top international game. So, it's just, Zach, honestly, mate, it's just the fitness of our bowlers is an ongoing concern across formats. We cannot keep our best bowlers fit long enough. You talk about scheduling. We can talk about the impact it has on the body, for especially once you've reached that threshold, right? I think we've talked about this before, over a certain amount of miles. Like when you're pushing into the 90s, the damage that can do to your body is just so much more. Think about Mark Wood and Archer and other players like that. But yeah, I'll be honest, we'll put a pin in this for now, but I'm not hugely expectant, I think, for this World Cup. I think it could be a tough one.
I do agree, and we are going to come on to the Asia Cup in part two, so we will focus on those teams then. I do think, however, there aren't that many good teams for this World Cup. No one looks particularly good. Australia could be all right. That's another bit of squad news that's come out since we last did a podcast, is that they have announced their squad and Tim David is in it, which is very exciting. I'm, as listeners to the podcast will know, I'm a big fan of Tim David. He's very, very good at just, you know, whacking the ball pretty far. I think that addition will be interesting to see how they do it, whether they do still play Steve Smith or whether they drop Steve Smith for him and they have kind of a finishing order of kind of Stoinis, Maxwell, Stoinis, David, Wade at seven. It's a pretty solid, you know, finishing batting lineup with an informed David Warner at the top. Aaron Finch also not looked very good. But yes, it'd be interesting to see how Australia go. You know, they should probably be the favourites because they're at home. And, you know, they know, no one knows the conditions better than they do. But yeah, other than them, no one else looks very good. India will be good, but no one else looks great, I don't think.
Absolutely. Yeah, a nice bit of optimism, I think, to end part one for the state of the international T20 game. We'll be talking about the Asia Cup and the 100, which just wrapped up. In just a few moments after this break, and looking forward to see how teams like India may not be doing as well as it might be expected in the cup so far. So stick with us, and we'll be back to talk about all of that and a bit more in part two. All right, welcome back to Rain Stop Play, our first podcast in exactly a month. It's been really enjoyable so far. Obviously talked about England versus South Africa, touched on the T20 World Cup squads, and sticking with that format, right, Zach, before we conclude with the 100, which is a format unto itself, I guess, at this point. The Asia Cup is currently ongoing. I'm going to be honest, I don't know a huge amount about what's kind of happened so far. I am aware that the kind of format is a little bit maybe confusing to an extent as well. So, Zach, for listeners, I know a lot of our listeners will be very, very much secure in their Asia Cup knowledge, but just very briefly for folks who might not be following it so closely, you know, who's playing, how does it work, and the best question of all, who's looked good so far?
So the way it's worked is there are two group stages. There's six teams in it: India, Pakistan, Hong Kong. They were one group, and then Afghanistan, Sri Lanka, and Bangladesh were the other group. So again, it's like every international cricket tournament. There's no draw for the groups. India and Pakistan always end up in the same group. No idea how that happens. So in this tournament, they could play each other three times because they both beat Hong Kong, shockingly. Who knew they'd beat Hong Kong? So they both went through to now it's in a Super Four stage where every team plays every team again. So they played each other again on Sunday, which was, of course, yesterday or 2 days ago when you're listening to this. And Pakistan actually chased down 181 in a really good chase. India looked really devoid of ideas, to be honest. And Virat Kohli's had a couple of innings where he's got runs, but has he got them quick enough? No, is a simple answer. You know, and people probably aren't going to like to hear that, but he hasn't scored runs quick enough, and it's a consistent problem. And I think India look like luster. Pakistan don't look amazing either, but potentially they went for a slightly different direction with it. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see whether both those teams end up in the final, because they could play each other again in the final. That's how it works. The Super Fours, the top twos, go through to the final. But yeah, the problem with this tournament is it's lacking no Shaheen and no Bumrah. So there's kind of that, you know, that big kind of best quicks in the world are missing from this tournament. So it's kind of you can judge India, and India look lackluster. They look lackluster at the death. But like we were saying earlier with England and Jofra Archer, you add Bumrah back in, it's a different story. Again, Pakistan don't look amazing, but you add Shaheen back in, it's a different story. The one team that's been interesting to me is I thought Afghanistan looked really good in their first couple of games. They bowled Sri Lanka out really cheaply in their first game for 105 and then chased it down in 10.1 overs. Gurbaz scoring 40 from 18 balls. In their second game, they then kept Bangladesh to 127 for 7. Mujeeb taking 3 for 16 from his 4 overs, so looking so good. Rashid Khan, you know, doing what Rashid Khan does. And they've also got Fazal Haq, in the World Cup, they were really missing a fifth bowler, basically. They had Mujeeb, they had Rashid Khan, they had the pacer Naveen Ul Haq, and they had Nabi as well. And then, you know, the couple of other options for a couple of those, but they were missing. Fazal Haq is a left arm seamer. You know, not particularly quick, but you know, quick enough. So that's interesting to see how he goes and keeps going, because that's another bowler. And obviously, again, he's only about 21. All the Afghanistan players other than Mohammad Nabi seem to be about 21, 22. Mujeeb looking absolutely brilliant. So yeah, I think Afghanistan looked pretty good. They did lose to Sri Lanka, however, the other day in their first Super Four game. They set Sri Lanka 175 to win and didn't manage to defend it, which isn't very Afghanistan-y. They usually don't go for that many runs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's a bit of a worry. Rashid Khan going for 39 in his 4 overs is something that you just don't seem to ever see. Mm-hmm. So yeah, bit of a worry. Gurbaz did get 84 from 45 balls in that game though, so he is looking very good with the bat. Couple of interesting games coming up in the next couple of days. I think Pakistan, Afghanistan on Wednesday is one I've already earmarked to be like, yeah, definitely want to try and watch a bit of that. Be interesting to see how that goes. And yeah, the final is it finishes this weekend, so it finishes on Sunday. So it's a really quick tournament. It's the Asia Cup has historically been a 50 over tournament, but the last two now have been T20 tournaments, which is the way of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a really interesting note to kind of as we look maybe towards the 100 in just a moment. That's a really interesting point, Zach. I obviously have been aware of the tournament, but I wasn't aware that it had made that kind of format shift. And as you said, that's very much a product of wider trends, right? Talk about the Royal London One Day Cup being kind of relegated to a second tier competition domestically in England. Talk about players, you know, just saying that they're not happy. We talked about this in the last podcast. You know, the one day game looks to be in a kind of state of purgatory right now. That's great. And maybe Zach, you know, maybe one, what's your kind of one or two takeaways that you think are going to really make an impact on the World Cup moving forward? Have you seen anything in the Asia Cup so far that's made you maybe rethink your predictions, or, you know, have there maybe been players emerging that seem like they're going to be pivotal players in a couple of months' time?
I think it's worth caveating that the conditions are very different. So this is being played in the UAE, which we are we are all a little bit fed up of cricket in the UAE, to be honest. We had a hell of a lot of it during COVID, understandably. You know, it's a very good place for them to have bubbles. And this again was a tournament that was last minute moved there. So nothing against the UAE. I just like seeing cricket in different places. This was meant to be in Sri Lanka, this tournament, but because of political unrest, was moved to the UAE. So, you know, fair enough. You had to move it somewhere. It's a good place to just be able to kind of bam, last minute move a tournament to. But I do want to see some cricket elsewhere, to be honest.
Absolutely.
We felt like we've seen a lot of it in the last couple of years. But yeah, so that's worth caveating anything I kind of go on to say. Pakistan look pretty decent, but Babar Azam's in terrible form, so that could cause a problem. India's the really interesting one, because if they keep playing, that this is not necessarily what they're playing in the Asia Cup, but if they decide to play KL Rahul, Rohit Sharma and Kohli in one side, I think they're going to cost themselves. They're going to cost themselves the World Cup. They've got so much talent, but there's
they do.
The fact that there are question marks over whether Suryakumar Yadav makes a team is just absurd. The fact that there's even question, I think he will play. There's no doubt about it. But the fact that it even gets talked about that there's potential he won't play is absurd. He gets into any team. I think he's probably the best T20 batter in the world right now. Him, Butler, Warner, but again, Butler, Warner play, they open the batting, which is easier in T20 cricket. The ball's harder, the field's up. So Suryakumar Yadav comes in three, sometimes four, sometimes even five for India, which is such a harder place to bat, and he performs. He's so good. So I think with him there, they can win any game. But if that top three are there, all playing their kind of nerdly innings, KL Rahul had an absolute shocker against Hong Kong. Scored at less than a run a ball for 40. And I'm sorry, Hong Kong, but, you know, India should have battered Hong Kong. And they did. Of course, they did in the end. But that was basically because Suryakumar Yadav came in and scored 68 from 26 balls. Because KL Rahul had scored a less than a run a ball 36. Which is, yeah, it's causing themselves problems that they don't need to have. They have such a depth of talent that they have better players than this. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, you know, going into a tournament and you see some teams kind of suffering from this, right? They got almost an overabundance of talent, right? It's a double-edged sword, because you're going to be leaving players out who are match winners onto their own right. And it actually, Zach, I guess it heaps the pressure on the players who are picked, because they need to perform every game or they could be tumbling out. Yeah, really good stuff. Well, thank you for a quick chat on that. Yeah, it's a really good tournament. It's a really fun one. I'm going to try and watch at the very least the final, but hopefully another game or two leading up to that. And yeah, it is going to give us a bit of an indication, conditions aside, excellent caveat there, Zach, to see, you know, who's in form, what players are in form as we kind of start building up to what should be a really entertaining World Cup after a bit of a damp squib. I think it's fair to say the last one, which I don't think many of us enjoyed at all. Okay, we're getting towards time, but we do want to conclude the pod with a very, you know, kind of quick chat about the 100, which just finished its second season. Obviously, the only place it's played is the UK. And yeah, it's just wrapped up over the weekend just gone. The Oval Invincibles in the Women's 100 beat Southern Brave in a repeat of last year's final to win the second title ever and their second title. I think there's something to be said, Zach, we'll get onto in a second, about, well, are they maybe too good? Are these teams just simply too strong with the Invincibles and Brave? And then moving over to the Men's 100, which I think it's fair to say has been probably lagging behind the women's in terms of maybe potentially arguably quality and in terms of names. But in the 100 men's final, the Trent Rockets, thanks to a match-winning knock from Lewis Gregory in the final five balls, beat the Manchester Originals. It was low scoring, the game. It probably wasn't the centerpiece that the organizers, promoters wanted. There weren't that many boundaries scored, actually, especially sixes. But it was actually a thriller. It went right down to the final set. And I think, sadly, as I touched on earlier, Richard Gleeson probably would have backed himself with the ball to win it for the Manchester Originals. And Lewis Gregory, obviously Somerset player for Zach and I, did the business, consecutive boundaries, and made it look easy. Zach, you know, 100 discourse has been ongoing ever since obviously it was announced a long time ago. Now we've just concluded the second tournament. It's worth reiterating, it's only the second time it's happened ever. And yeah, I mean, just big picture stuff from me just to get the ball rolling. As I kind of mentioned there, it maybe feels like the women's 100, it just seems like more of a complete package than the men's one. We can maybe talk about why that difference is in just a few moments, especially a kind of absence of some really key players for the men's side of it. I was reading just before we got on the pod, correct me if I'm wrong here, that it seems to be that attendance, in-person attendance, seem to go up a little bit from last year. There seem to be pretty good attendance figures and ticket sales, but people watching it on TV, viewing figures dropped roughly, I think, 20% on last year, which is a pretty big decrease. And, you know, maybe what are the reasons for that? And I think what we were excited to talk about, Zach, right, is what does the 100 need to do? If it's here, we've got a TV deal for the next couple of years. If it is here to stay, right, what does it need to improve to become a better, I guess, product, to use the kind of jargon that the ECB loves so much? So, Zach, yeah, what are your kind of headlines from this tournament, just to conclude the pod?
Yeah, I think it's really difficult, because the obvious thing for me that the 100 needs to do is it needs to be on the BBC every single day rather than the odd game. Because I've had a few people who I know don't really watch cricket, including my mum, who've said to me, "Oh, I was watching the women's 100 the other yesterday, really enjoyed it." And then she's like, the next day she was like to me, "Oh, I can't watch the next game. Why is the next game not on the BBC?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, because they're just doing, you know, one a week." I think they weren't helped by the BBC ended up with the BBC's games ended up not being good games. They had a couple of dead rubbers at the end. They had a dead rubber that was on at the same time as Man United playing Liverpool, which that is kind of hard for you to plan for. So I think that will have affected it. There was a few dead rubbers at the end of the tournament because of just some teams being bad, which you can't really plan for. When you do a draft tournament, you do expect the kind of there to be more competitive games. So it is tough. But yeah, I think if everyone wants it to be this a big thing that gets more people into cricket, which I think was kind of a lot of the aim, then it needs to be on free-to-air TV. Simple as, and you need to be on the BBC every day, and so people can follow the narrative of it.
Yeah, I guess the kind of simple, not necessarily rebuttal to that point, but I guess critique of maybe this issue writ large is, you know, there should just be more free-to-air cricket across all formats, especially the women's game, right, Zach, on BBC, right?
Yeah, completely. I think, but there is then an issue with this, because a rebuttal to it would be that a lot of the women's games are put on YouTube for free, but that's different. You still have to search it out. It's better than nothing, but it's not the same as you being able to, a casual viewer who doesn't know about it, just putting their TV on and being like, "Oh, what should we watch this evening? Oh, there's cricket on. Oh, I like cricket, but, you know, I don't follow it that much. Let's stick it on. Oh, game on tomorrow is there. Oh, we'll stick a bit of that on," you know. It makes a difference. And then, like you said, you can follow the narrative. But it's difficult.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I think, yeah, a really good point there, Zach. I think it's great that it is reaching maybe some folks that wouldn't usually be tuning it, especially people who don't have your Sky subscriptions, who won't be on YouTube kind of scouring out these. You need to have that insider knowledge to find those games on YouTube, right? No one's going to just kind of wander into them. And it's a really good point, especially for the men's side of the game, just for a moment. Barney Rene wrote a quite a funny piece last Friday for The Guardian titled "Fire and Loathing, the 100 and its Pyrotechnics Will Strangle Cricket." Right. And he kind of really zones in on the Welsh Fire men's team who lost every single game this season, which was pitiful, to be honest, especially as, I guess, in theory, Zach, they're meant to be our team. Is that correct? As a Somerset fan, they're meant to be our team. Really sad stuff. So I just want to read off a quick quote from it, which I found very, very entertaining. So he said, quote, "Welsh Fire is still basically just a name, some clothing, some words on the internet. Losing 8-8 is Welsh Fire men's 100 team's most convincing claim to any kind of actual life. Could this be the most grippingly pointless sporting entity ever created in this country? Here we have a losing machine in a space where losing doesn't matter, but where it must be broadcast to the nation 8 times in 29 days by a cult-like TV commentary crew willing to pretend energetically that Welsh Fire losing has any objective meaning." And that's the quote. I just really enjoyed it. He's a good writer, but I really enjoyed you know, the kind of critique there, I guess, in a way, the same way that you can critique, I guess, American sports, whereby it doesn't really matter if your franchise loses. You can actually gain from it if you, obviously, if you get higher draft picks. Don't have to get into the nuance there. But Welsh Fire losing 8 games on its merits isn't very good, right, Zach, for, you know, maybe the balance of the tournament. And we can bring this into the women's side too, with the same 2 teams being in the final in consecutive years. How do you think they can, could or should fix this imbalance between teams who are either doing brilliantly or who no team should lose 8 games in a row of? It's just pathetic, really. Where do you think that can be fixed moving forward? Because that can create more dead rubbers, which feels like a real issue, especially if they're the ones being broadcast on BBC.
Yeah, I think the key thing that, and it is something that is being solved in part next year. So there's going to be a special window for the 100 for 3 weeks. So England's test players or England's best players will all be able to play, because the Welsh Fire, if you add Johnny Bairstow into their batting lineup, don't lose 8 games. You know, Johnny Bairstow probably on his own wins them 2 of those games, and potentially if they get a bit luckier with, they've been a bit unlucky with some overseas kind of availability. They had Nazeem Shah for a couple games, but you know, Asia Cup being on. And there's also been a lot of players who've now gone to the CPL and have been picked up because they weren't initially picked up in the 100. They were only replacements. They've chosen to go to the CPL above staying at the 100. So, for example, Tabrez Shamsi could have played in the final for the Trent Rockets, but chose to go to a CPL franchise for the start of the CPL. So that's something they need to do moving forward, as well as having the specialist window, which I think for the tournament as a whole is a good thing. They need to kind of discuss this with other boards. You know, it needs to not cross over the CPL. Or if it does, they need to have some sort of system in place. And they also need to kind of, you know, it's unlucky there's an Asia Cup this year. There's not an Asia Cup every year. That's kind of taken out a lot of players. There was a lot of Pakistani players in the tournament. A few, Rashid Khan was there from Afghanistan, and Hasaranga as well. Like, you know, these are some of the best players in the world. I think that's what's been missing from the men's tournament, is you've not had the best overseas talent playing the whole tournament, or at least playing a big chunk of the tournament. And that's something you have had for the women. You know, we've had for the Southern Brave, okay, Amanda J. Wellington can't get in the Australia women's side, but she is one of the best players, which is one of the best spinners in the world. Oval Invincibles have got Danae van Niekerk, they've got Shabnam Ismail. We've had, you know, Laura Woolvard has been the top run scorer for the women's side. These are some of the biggest names in women's cricket. You know, Beth Mooney, all of the kind of big Australian players, mostly, you know, apart from, you know, Meg Lanning, who's having a break from cricket, completely understandably, they are all playing. So, and that, you know, brings into it the best England players are playing. You know, you've got Alice Capsey playing with Danae van Niekerk at Oval Invincibles. And that's what you want to see.
Cool. All right. Well, we are kind of over time, I guess. There's been loads for us to catch up on. I've really enjoyed chatting. Thank you to everyone for listening to our kind of comeback pod, our kind of post-holiday catch up. As we touched on, I think our next pod, most likely, unless, Zach, there's an emergency pod of some kind, i.e. Archer, Archer plays the test on Thursday. We might have to do a podcast for that. We're going to do a much kind of bigger review of the summer, probably some awards, some highs and lows, one of those really kind of fun, silly pods. That's probably going to be our next one in a couple of weeks when Dan is back from the US. We'll get a full Rainstop Playhouse for that. But until then, oh, Zach, you got something?
No, just as well as that, look forward to our T20 World Cup podcasts. We'll be back. We're going to be talking about those associate nations that we really enjoyed covering last year, and we're going to do that all over again.
Absolutely. I think the Minnows pod was probably collectively our favorite one ever, and that was a lot of fun. So looking forward to that. So lots of big content coming up soon, loads of really exciting things to look forward to, and a lot of great cricket to enjoy. So yeah, Zach, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Glenn.
Appreciate it. And yeah, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you soon for a big Rainstop Play summer review.